Test 1, 2.
Shirley.
Those days.
Chairman Dever.
Here.
Kretzbach. Marsali.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Wardner. Representative Blue. Boehning. Frosa.
Here.
Grandy. Carls.
Here.
Casper.
Here.
Metcalf. Meyer. Nathy.
Here.
Ruby.
Here.
Rust.
Here.
Thorson. Weiler. Wieland.
Here.
Chairman, you have a quorum.
Okay, thank you. First item is comments by the chairman, and I'd just like to mention that I'm feeling much better in the last half hour. Had a little shot of oxygen. And there was a Catholic priest sitting behind me, and I asked him if he was there for last rites, and he was there for other purposes.
Mr. Chairman, did they take a vote on whether or not to revive you?
I understand there was a vote taken after I left the room. Senator Mathern asked if he had found a heart, if Dr. Berry had found a heart. Dr. Berry responded, we wouldn't be able to accept a transplant from the senator from District 21 because it, or 11 because it's already bleeding.
Mr. Chairman, he said 21, not 11, and so I wasn't.
Well, regarding the committee responsibilities, we're slated to have one more meeting after this. It'll be next week, Thursday. These are semi-final reports, I think, that we're receiving today. We, Representative Grandy and I, had a conversation one day with the two majority leaders and with the chairs of the Appropriations Committee. I'm not sure there's going to be a need for any kind of legislation or direction to come from this committee, so we're basically receiving the reports and helping the Hay Group to put them in the order that will be most useful to us. That means then that the funding for state employee pay raises, as I understand it, will go out in the 2-2, 2-2, and 1-1 to the different agencies as it's slated. And if there's seen a need to increase that, they'll make that consideration in the OMB in certain areas that will help to move this forward. 3-3. Yeah. I said 2-2 and 1-1. Okay. So we'll meet today, we'll meet again next week, and we hope to have some good information from the Hay Group. Their contract runs through the end of June, though, so there will be some things that they'll be working on after that. So with that, the Hay Group.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh, wow. Now you're really awake, aren't you? Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to meet with you again today. And before I start, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Melinda Riley, who is with me. Melinda specializes in the benefits benefits aspect of our business. And because we know that you've had significant interest in the level of competitiveness of benefits, which we've touched on briefly in previous presentations, today we're going to go into more detail in terms of when we say you're at a particular level of competitiveness of benefits, what does that mean and why do we make that statement, so that you have a total compensation perspective from which to make decisions, so decisions can be made in terms of the recommended salary structures. You have a copy, and for the audience, the presentation that we're going to go through is on the screen, and once again, because you have multiple pages, members of the committee have multiple pages per page. Wow, you have multiple pages. Oh, it's getting worse. You have multiple pages per page. Oh, why is this happening? Where's Elton John when I need him? When I refer to a page number, it'll be the page number of the slide, not the page number that you have, which is the little number on each of these pages. You recall that we met on the 3rd of March to provide, because that was the first meeting that this State Employee Oversight Committee had had. Some of you had been on the Government Services Committee, others hadn't. And so basically what we did then was bring you up to speed as to what work we were doing on the 10 components that came out, the recommendations that came out of the audit. And you recall at that point, in that presentation on the 3rd of March, we mentioned we were working on particular components that enabled you as legislators to be in a position to be able to focus on the main thing, which was, is there a fiscal impact of the work that we are doing? And in subsequent discussions with the Legislative Council, what we're asked to do was focus today on what's set out on page 3, which is the market competitiveness of salary benefits and total compensation, the development of a grade structure, which is the placement of jobs into grades, the development of salary structure options, and then the fiscal impact of the salary structures, and then what were referred to as other issues. And then the last page, which is next steps, which will please you when we get there because it's blank. But that's really the direction that you give us today in preparation for next week. So we're going to focus today. I'm not going to spend time on the components that we have. They are the components, by the way, that we've been primarily concentrating on. Because remember, the timetable that was set so that you would know any potential fiscal impact before you leave town. Some of the other areas that we're working on, such as firming up the definition of recruitment retention, firming up the definition of vacancy savings, will be done within the context of the plan that is adopted. Okay, so let's move, and Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you want me to, if you want to allow questions as we go through, or we do what, the same as last time, if people have questions they want to ask them, I'll leave it over to you as to how you want to handle it. You recall that in the audit last year, we concluded that the definition of the market used for the current salary structure wasn't necessarily in line with your competitive market. You primarily use the in-state market and central states data for grades 1 through 10, but you were primarily using just other states for grades 11 through 20. So for supervisory professional managerial jobs, you weren't really taking into consideration the in-state market. And so, for example, for a professional level nursing position, you weren't comparing with the hospital down the road, which didn't make a whole lot of sense. The current salary ranges were set at 95% of the market, and you recall that in our audit we found that in fact they were anywhere between 10% below market to 3% above market, and the average comp ratio, which is where people were paid relative to the midpoint of their salary ranges, was 93%. And you recall that a number that was on an aggregate basis that was floated around was on average you were 12% behind the market, which was that 5%, 95% of market, which is where the midpoints were set, an average comp ratio of 93 through the salary range, 7 plus 5, on average about 12% behind. Now that's on an aggregate basis, it doesn't apply to every job, but that was a number that was sort of floated around. And that becomes important when we see what the impact. Remember, that was done pre the 5% that came into effect July the 1st this last year. So in order to gather more appropriate data, we went out and we've gathered data from a number of sources based on 162 benchmark positions. And that's a cross-section of the 900 classifications. And we gathered it on page 5. We gathered it from a number of sources. We did a custom survey. We were in-state employers, public and private, roughly 53 public and private sector organizations representing about 6,500 employees. The 10 central states that you've used before. From our own existing database within the Hay Group, an additional 123 organizations. The data from North Dakota Job Service, which is roughly 4,500 organizations. And data from the North Dakota Healthcare Foundation, which was 42 organizations. Our aim was to build a much more comprehensive database from which to establish a salary policy for going forward. Now, there is little point in comparing the competitiveness of the current salary midpoints or the ranges with the market, because for a primary reason, that you recall that I presented to you in March that we'd gone through and we revisited the grade allocation of every position through the job evaluation process, and we have established a new grade structure. Currently, your grade structure is called grades 1 through 20. It won't be called 1 through 20 going forward. We won't even be using numbers. And the reason we do that is that if someone was in a grade 10 previously, and now they are in a grade 8, and even if that range is $20,000 higher, they don't even hear the second part. They were a 10, now they're an 8, and you can talk to your blue in the face, but they think, which is what you were recently, in the last hour, but they think they went down. So we will not be calling them numbers going forward. We'll call them letters or whatever we choose, but they won't be numeric. So of more meaning is to compare your current salaries to the market. And we did that. And what we found on average across the benchmark jobs was that you are now 7% behind the market average. Now, if you think about that, last year your market policy, your ranges were set at 95% of market. The average compa ratio was 93%. The 5 plus 7 is 12. You gave on average, not everyone got the same, but on average the funding last year in July was 5%. So now let's back 5 off 12. The market didn't move a lot in the last year, so we didn't create these numbers to come out this way, but it's not surprising now that you're about, on average, on your benchmarks, about 7% behind market. Now, that's on based on the benchmarks on an aggregate basis. What we were asked to do was then say, well, how does that look on an occupational group basis? How does that look on an agency basis? And how does that look on a funding source basis? We can do it on occupational group, we can do it on agency. It's very difficult to do on a funding source basis. Laurie's smiling, because you can have an employee who may be funded out of three, part of their funding may come from the general fund, some may come from a federal fund, and some may come from a special fund, and that's one employee. So, for example, we found there was an employee where 1% of their salary was funded from a special fund. Well, that's very difficult to do that analysis. We think what's more meaningful is to do it on a occupational group and an agency basis. So based on those 162 benchmarks, what we then did was we went through and compared the current pay to the market by occupational group. And what you have here on page 7 are the major occupational groups that have been used, that are currently used. So clerical, fiscal, administrative, we separated out IT there. Basically, they pay, the current pay is in line with market. And you can see there, minus 2, medical, public health, that's actually a job of pharmacist, whereas further on, you can see we also broke out nursing, and then there's the rest of medical, public health down at minus 11, and so on. Now, where are the significant number of populations in terms of the classifications? Third from the bottom, social service, mental health, and rehabilitation is a significant number of classifications. And while overall, and you can see that's how we arrived at the 7%, that occupational group is 13% behind the market. Education, recreation, museum, library, allied, 14%. So what this does is it takes the 7%, which was an aggregate across all, and basically says, but how are we doing on particular occupational groups? Then what we did was we broke it out by agencies. And this is set out on pages 8 and 9. Now we have a word of caution here. This is only based on the 162 benchmark positions. So one agency may have only had one or two positions that were included as benchmarks, and if they had new employees who are at the bottom of the range because they've just been hired within the last year, then their pay may be quite low. And so I don't want to create, well, gosh, I'm from Protection and Advocacy Project, we on average pay, yeah, I see your hand. We on average pay 25% behind the market, because there may have only been one or two benchmark jobs, particularly on the smaller agencies. But you can see here where the agencies that pay well based on the benchmarks relative to that market average. And as you can see across all of them, it comes to that minus 7. So the picture, minus 7 on an aggregate basis, then by occupational group, then by agency. And I believe one of the reasons we're asked to do that is for going forward, is there any particular agencies that are going to need more money than others in terms of potential implementation? So, to summarize the competitiveness on salary, overall 7% behind the much more better defined market, consistent with the compensation philosophy, some ranges across occupational groups, and also some ranges across agencies. Now what Melinda's going to do is, so that we can get to a total compensation perspective, she's now going to talk through the benefits. So this is salary, now benefits, so we can see, and the number I want you to keep in mind for going forward as she does her benefits presentation from a salary perspective is on average 7% behind the market. I'm going to hand over to Melinda and she's going to talk you through the benefits competitiveness.
Can I ask first if there are any questions so far? Nope. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what I'm going to do is provide a little context of our methodology for analyzing benefits and comparing them to the market, because it's a little bit different than comparing a salary figure. So first of all, as Neville mentioned, we are wanting to provide a little context in the benefits so that when you're making a total compensation decision, you're not looking at it in silos. So with our evaluation on slide 11, talking a little bit about how we kind of show or demonstrate your market position compared to the comparator group. And consistent with the compensation study, we did use the central states. We do have complete benefits data on all of those state governments, as well as private and public sector organizations that are represented in the state. And we assess the competitiveness using the same kind of market median, P50. If it's in the upper quartile, P75. If it's below the lower quartile, P25. Next slide, slide 12, talks a little bit about our methodology. And what we want to get straight here when we're talking about benefits is that we're not talking about costs. We're not comparing the actual what it costs to provide these benefits. We're talking about the value that the plan provisions have to, and it's more of a perceived value that they have to your employees. So, for example, we would place a value on the deductible level in a healthcare plan, or the amount of contributions that an employee pays for their coverage, the formula in a retirement plan, the amount of life insurance that's provided, and not necessarily what it costs the state to provide that. And one example that did come up during the course of this analysis is that the healthcare premiums that the state pays are quite competitive in actual dollars when you look at the other central states. However, looking at that only, that wouldn't take into account different demographics. It wouldn't take into account the plan design differences, and that's what we want to kind of strip away the impact of your market and the demographics and truly focus on the design of your program. The next slide, we do show that we look at the full range of benefits that are offered. So healthcare insurance, retirement plans, death benefits, paid time off, disability and sick leave, and then a category of other benefits that might have some employer contributions. And so when we calculate these benefit values so that we can compare them to the market, we're looking, the key driver is, are they provided on an employer-paid basis? Okay, so to the extent that they're fully paid for by the employer, then they are not discounted. We give 100% value to that. But if they're cost-shared or if they're more of a sharing, then that's discounted and that reduces the value of the benefit to the employee. Another aspect of our methodology, because we do calculate this based on what someone's salary is that there's internal equity. So there is a relationship between someone's pay and their benefits. So some benefits are a function of pay. So a defined, the pension plan is a function of your pay, whereas healthcare is a flat dollar. So no matter what you earn, the value of that healthcare benefit is the same regardless of your salary. So that's some differences just within public equity. Okay, so now we get to the results. As I mentioned earlier, we have two comparator groups of the 10 central states, and then also private and public sector organizations that are within North Dakota. Okay, and our analysis generally showed that the current benefits program is at most 7% above market, and the primary driver of the level of competitiveness is the retirement plan. It's also important to note that all other components of benefits are either at or below the market median, or the P50. So on slide 16, I'm going to focus on some of the reasons for either an above market position or a below market provision position, so get a little better understanding. So on healthcare, we have valued that is a market median benefit based on the two, both markets, both private sector and the central states. And a few features that are above market would be the fact that there are no employee contributions, premium contributions out of their pay to pay for that coverage. However, and what we see in the market is about a 15% to 29% range is where we see in the market is typical for both employee coverage as well as family coverage. But on the flip side, there are several provisions of the state's plan that are below market. And typically we see in the market a 90% or 100% coinsurance. So that's the amount that an employee or the plan pays after they reach the deductible. North Dakota has an 80% coinsurance. Something that's not common in the market is a separate prescription out-of-pocket maximum. Generally, there's an out-of-pocket maximum that is included for all medical expenses, but there's an additional amount, and that's not very common, and it serves to increase the amount that an employee might pay out-of-pocket. And also in dental, employee paid, typically we see that as a cost-shared item rather than fully paid for by the employee. So the combination of those two things balance out and create the market median position. Moving on to retirement, within the private sector, the prevalence of a defined benefit plan is lower than we see in the public sector. However, they're still offered by the prevalence is about 40% of the market, is what we're seeing in this particular comparator group. The state plan is competitive; it's a competitive benefit formula, and the vesting provisions are also competitive. And the fact that currently no employee contributions are required is somewhat above what we see in other states. There's quite a combination within the central states of some employees being required to pay that portion, whereas there are others that the state's covering it or they're paying it. Below market is really the fact that the defined contribution plan, which is much more prevalent in the private sector, is that there's no employer contribution towards that plan, which you might say in the form of an employer match. What we see is actually in the market is 50% of states and 85% of the general market that have a pension plan also make some sort of contribution to a defined contribution plan. So there's kind of a combination of approach to retirement funding. On the next slide, the remainder of the benefits are covered. Time off, paid time off, is something that is the schedules are very competitive against both markets.
Melinda, I wonder if you would take a question from Representative
sure.
Grandy.
Yes, Chairman.
Thank you, Melinda. On this, where you're talking about the match and the pension plans having the contributions, and were you talking about whether or not a combination plan was being offered, or are you just going, your statement there, the general market has the pension plans, the matching contributions, but then you referred to like the 457, yet we do offer that 457, so we, did you take that into consideration there, or?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we did take that into account, that you offer a 457 plan. However, that is only, it's open to employees to defer their own money. However, there's no incentive provided by the employer, you know, in terms of matching contributions. So that doesn't carry a lot of value in our methodology, because there's no employer, you know, it's kind of, you're providing access to an employee to defer their own money, but there's no match going in. Does that make sense?
Right, I thought we gave a percentage off of that. Okay, go ahead.
And also, just as a follow-on to that, we compare defined contribution plans, so 457 plans, we compare those individually, we compare defined benefit plans, pension plans individually, but then we combine them in order to get a total retirement picture. So it takes into account that some, you know, some employers provide a combination of all those.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay. So back to slide 17, I mentioned time off is in line with market. The death benefit is showing as below P25, but we'll explain a little bit why that's the case. But the life insurance benefit is provided as a flat dollar, $1,300, regardless of salary, so it's not tied. What we might typically see in the market is a slightly higher maximum, or a benefit that is tied to salary. So maybe a function of one times pay is very common in the market. With regard to disability, there is no maximum placed on the number of sick days, so that is a positive for the state's program. But generally, we see in the market that there's not only sick leave, but also some sort of short-term disability benefit, that the combination of those two provides the short-term disability benefit. Long-term disability is provided through the pension plan, which is something that's becoming increasingly uncommon. Typically what we see is that 90% provide a separate long-term disability benefit. It's not integrated with the pension plan. And that's true, that 90% is of the states, but then we also, it's nearly 100% of the private sector market provides a long-term disability benefit as a standalone benefit and not integrated with retirement. The other category is meant to capture other sort of work-life benefits that the state may make a contribution towards, either tuition reimbursement, daycare. There's not a significant amount of contributions here, so that is below P25.
Okay, Representative Grandy.
When you talk about not a significant amount, but it says no tuition reimbursement, but we, each agency has the ability, and they do have policy in place for tuition reimbursement.
Yes, we, there was a lot of variation in the program, and we were informed that there's a lot of discretion at the agency level to provide that, but since there was no statewide uniform benefit, we decided not to value that, you know. So I mean, it's because it's not uniform across all populations. And to follow on to that, this category relative to the other categories of benefits does not carry a significant weight in the total. If you figure benefits as a pie, the other category is not a huge. Retirement, health care, and time off are the three biggest drivers of benefits value. Okay. So on slide 18, I want to just talk about a little bit more of some additional comments than we made in our previous reports. Typically in the market, what we see is a greater difference between P50 and P75 in terms of distinction between those programs. And we don't see that there's a lot of compression in this, in both the central states and even increasingly in the private sector. But what we see in the central states is a difference of only 10 to 12% between P50 and P75, and the private sector is a little bit larger at 12 to 15%. So we're seeing a little bit more compression than we might see in other comparator groups. Okay. So overall, our assessment is that the market position is at P50, slightly above compared to both markets. And as mentioned earlier, primarily that above market position is driven by the retirement plan. Okay. I want to touch on this. You want to talk about that? Okay.
What I want to do now is come back and talk about the issue that we're asked to address, which is and this is at the bottom of page 19 and then onto page 20. And you recall, Senator and committee members, that one of the ideas that was being floated around was the concept of if the employees were asked to contribute 4% to the retirement plan and then they were given a salary increase to offset that to effectively make it cost neutral, what would that do to the competitive position in terms of what was shown in terms of salary and benefits. Now, hopefully you've seen by the methodology that has been explained by Melinda, it would decrease because we take it on an employer-paid basis, and if the employee is required to contribute, then it's going to reduce the competitiveness of a particular benefit. And so for retirement, it would reduce the competitiveness of that. But as we set out at the bottom of page 19, there would be a corresponding increase in the competitiveness of the salary position. So for example, on the salary position, if everyone tomorrow was given in terms of the way I explained the salary positioning before, if everyone tomorrow was given a 5% salary increase, and we're at 93% of market today, we'd be at 98% of market tomorrow. You know, on an aggregate basis, but the level of competitiveness of the benefits would be reduced. And while it's not exactly dollar for dollar, it pretty much does offset. However, as set out on page 20, I cannot prove this because we can't project forward the impact. But it is our opinion that by doing that option that was being considered, asking employees to contribute 4% and giving them a salary increase to offset would cost the state more in the long run for three reasons. One is there would be a compounding effect of increases on higher salaries. So if my salary today is, I'll use round numbers, if my salary today is $100,000, and I'm now going to be required to contribute 4% to my retirement, but I'm now doing it from $105,000 salary. In other words, I was given a 5% salary. Might put aside what I'm now being required to contribute for retirement and now just look at what my salary increases would be. If I'm going to get 3% next year and 3% the following year, etc., and I got 10 years to go to retirement, put aside the retirement part. I'm going to be getting salary increases compounded on a higher amount. Secondly, it's going to increase the cost of the Social Security contribution. And thirdly, it's going to increase the pension costs, which is what I was just touching on before, because my final salary for pension calculation purposes would be higher. You know, and you've got to compound that over a number of years. You know, if people expect to be retired for, you know, X years, and I know there's not a cost of living adjustment, but the salary on which my pension is calculated would be higher. So while what we're asked to do is say what impact would it have on market competitiveness. We think it's primarily a wash, but we believe because of those three reasons, it would cost the state more on a long-term basis. So salary roughly 7% behind market, benefits roughly 5 to 7% ahead of market. And so you could say, well, that's a wash. You know, we're in a good position here. So let's do some commentary on total compensation. And I've touched on the first three bullet. And you're by the way, the compensation philosophy, which is stated in House Bill 1031, which I believe is continuing to work its way through the process, said you'd take into consideration total compensation. Salary 7, benefits 5 to 7. The increased cost of the contribution to the retirement plan, not the 4-5 that I just talked about, but the 1-1 over the next 2 years, clearly, and based on our methodology, that will slightly decrease the level of competitiveness of the benefits, because the more an employee has to contribute to that, based on the methodology, the more that it will affect that. So in determining, what we have to then determine is, what level of competitiveness should we take in setting salary ranges? And setting salary ranges for going forward, I think there's an important point that's made at the bottom of 21. One is, while benefits are important to current employees, particularly the longer they've been here, numerous studies that we have and the marketplace will indicate what's important to someone starting out is cash compensation. They don't think so much about benefits. In fact, we're going to illustrate that to you at the moment. The most important salary that you should negotiate is your starting salary. And I'll show you the impact of that. And so the workforce of tomorrow will be coming and saying, what's my salary? That's not competitive. I want a higher salary. In addition, there are other cash compensation opportunities that are available in the private sector that you can't offer here. There may be bonuses, there may be incentives, or there may be an opportunity for wealth accumulation through stock programs. It's also important that you understand the impact of less competitive cash compensation in terms of its impact on career earnings. And you recall that I've made this statement before, salary is known value, benefits is perceived value. And you know, you've heard this saying before, there's a perception, and I've quoted on the third bullet point here, our benefits, particularly our retirement plan, and it's not just you, we hear this a lot in the public sector, you've seen the headlines recently. Our benefits, particularly our retirement plan, are so competitive that we don't need to be competitive on salary. There was a headline in USA Today about a month ago that said public sector pays higher than private sector in 41 states. And that's so inaccurate in terms of, because it's not comparing. Yep.
Representative Grandy,
sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's a stock program?
That's where there is an opportunity for the employee to purchase company stock at a discounted rate through the company they work for. They can purchase stock in that company on a discounted basis.
So we should start selling parts of the state? Is that what
Well, actually, you'd probably get a good, if you floated in North Dakota as an IPO, you'd get a really good price at the moment. That's what I told you, you can buy California for junk bond status. But yeah, Representative, I think you would have a high value. I'll be looking for you listed on the exchange tomorrow. That'd create some eye-openers, wouldn't it? So, what we've done, sorry.
Senator Nathan, or Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Neville, I just have a question in regards to the job situation as far as the perceived value. You know, a government job is much more is perceived to be much a safer job to have than, say, somebody in the private sector, because the government job is not really, what's the word I'm looking for, doesn't really affected by market forces, the stock market falling, those sorts of things, where if you're in a private sector job, you're much more affected by that, and your job safety could be jeopardized. So my point is that safety of a government job, is that perceived value in this, or is there room for that? Or
Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that was certainly the perception up to the last 2 or 3 years. But if you look at the number of people that have been laid off in the public sector, what you hear is of the news from the private sector. You're going to hear more layoffs in the public. And whenever you have an economic downturn, the impact on the public sector always lags, because you're dependent on, you know, revenue coming right from. And so what we're seeing is the lag impact, where layoffs have tended to tend to have bottomed in the private sector, they are still continuing in the public sector because of that lag impact. So, and also you have a trickle-down effect that occurs in the public sector, where a state would be impacted first, and then local government may be then impacted because they're getting some of their money. Feds to state to local, there's that trickle-down effect. I was at a seminar, a conference a couple months ago in DC about the impact and outlook for state and local governments, and they were talking about the decline that was still expected to come in public sector employment because of that lag that we impact. Can we put a value on it? I'm not sure you can put a dollar value on it, but I don't believe that the...
But Neville, could you put a perceived value on it like you do with the health benefits?
Well, the reason I mentioned about perceived value is that's not a quantified... Let me explain what perceived value is. It's not a dollar value, and perceived, basically, I'll get the illustration I've given before, Representative, is that every person in the audience, and probably you people, could tell me what your salary is if you're an employee of an organization. So that's a known value. Perceived value for benefits is because it depends on your state of life, your age, etc. And the example you've heard me give before is that if we're a group of 23-year-olds, single 23-year-olds, and I say, oh, I'm calling you together because we're going to double your life insurance, you'd get a so what, I don't expect to die. So there's low perceived value in doing that. Whereas if we're a group of 56-year-olds and I say I'm going to do something to your retirement plan, I'd get your attention. That's what I mean by perceived value. I think what you're talking about is there a perceived value of security in the public sector? I would say to a few years ago, there probably was, but I'm not sure there is anymore. I mean, when you see some jurisdictions that are laying off 50% of their workforce in law enforcement, you know, which is what's happening in some, and I should never use California examples, but that's what's happening, you know, where they're cutting their firefighters by half and those sort of things, then I think those people would say, what happened to that security? Just as I think in the private sector, we had that, someone employed by General Motors expect to be employed by General Motors for life, and it didn't happen anymore because Dad worked for General Motors and Granddad worked for General Motors, and so I'm not sure. At the seminar, Representative, they said we will never get back to the employment level we had in the public sector following this downturn. So,
thank you.
Representative Grandy.
Well, thank you. You know, I realize that as you're looking at this, you're looking at probably maybe a little bigger picture, but I want to stay focused on North Dakota.
Right.
And layoffs in North Dakota in the public sector, I'm not even sure, at least I know in my tenure it has not taken place in the 20 years that I've been involved here. But in state government and in prior too, so it's kind of hard to see that as
right. Well, let me
factor.
Okay, well, and you may be correct, but what I want to do now is go through the illustration of the fact, and on page 23 and 24, I want to prove to you that even though there's a perception that the retirement plan is so good we don't need to be competitive on salary, we're going to now prove to you that someone who joins on age 25 and works for an employer for 40 years will not only earn less on salary, that their retirement payout will be better, even though they haven't contributed. So I'm now going to walk you, Melinda, you want to come back up here? We're going to do sort of a tag team here. I'm going to do some salary parts, she's going to do some. So, and these are not assumptions made up to prove a case. These are based on very valid history of what's occurred on salary. So, we're now going to show that a private sector employer, someone starts in the private sector, age 25, and they start on $40,000. And on the same day, someone starts in the public sector, you could read state of North Dakota, at $36,000, about $10,000 less. Now, that's been pretty... roughly 10%, $4,000 less. If you go back over the last, we can't predict what salaries are going to do for the next 40 years, but if you look back over the last 40 years and look at the average increase in the private sector and the average increase in the public sector, it's been about 3% in the public and 4% in the private. So they both earn, they both start, and we're going to assume they're not going to change jobs. So before you turn to the next page, what do you think the difference would be in terms of salary earnings over those 40 years? Well, you can turn to the next page. It's $1.2 million. So, because over a 40-year period, that private sector employee is going to earn $3.993 million, and the public sector employee is going to earn $2.83, and their starting salary was $4,000 difference. So that's why I made the point before. Any of you have kids who are about to start into the workforce? The most important salary you can negotiate is your very first salary because of the compounding impact of salary increases over time. So first of all, there's going to be a salary difference. Now, Melinda's going to, now, in terms of the defined benefit formula, what we did there was we said, what's the typical, for those that have a defined benefit pension plan, what's the typical formula? It's 1.5 times salary. And on the right-hand column, 2%, that's your formula. Okay, so Melinda, talk about the assumptions at the bottom, and then we'll get on to the next page.
Okay. Yeah, and we used some very common, not overly conservative, not aggressive, actuarial assumptions for rate of return and employee contribution level. Because what we wanted to be able to compare is not only what North Dakota's retirement plan would be against a typical defined benefit plan in the market, but also what North Dakota's retirement plan would be against a typical defined contribution plan, which might be more is what's more typical in the private sector. So for that, we've used a rate of return annually of 7.5%. We've used that for both North Dakota too, in case because we have factored in an employee may decide to make some contributions of their own to the 457 plan.
Representative Rust has a question.
Thank you. My question is, and maybe I missed this, I see a defined benefit formula, public sector 2%. Why wouldn't you have used 4 for us?
Oh, the formula, so we're not talking about the contribution that is made as a percentage of salary. The 2% is the formula that determines what the final benefit is. And that benefit is 2% times final average pay times years of service to get that annuity. And it's the same for the 1.5, it's just that lower amount. Okay. We've assumed an employee.
Representative Casper.
Yes, what we're assuming here for a program for a private sector organization that may have a defined contribution plan only, so they don't have a pension, and so that 4% would be a combination of employer match or maybe just a fixed contribution as a function of pay. So it's an average, it's a market average of what we see for defined contribution retirement plans.
Whereas the state of North Dakota, the reason it's zero is that the state of North Dakota, for its 457, does not provide an employer match.
Continue.
The 457 is a different animal, as you know, than the defined contribution plan. So to compare the guidance of a 457 plan with a defined contribution, which is one of the things we've been having that we haven't voted on, but I think your assumptions are not fair to begin with and not justifiable.
Representative, what we're trying to compare is 457 plans, 403B, 401K. Those are all under the umbrella of a defined contribution plan. I mean, that it's not a fixed retirement. It's not a defined benefit. It's a defined contribution. So what goes in, what the employer puts in, is fixed as a function of pay when it goes in. And so that's why it isn't necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison to the 457-year program because you do not make an employer contribution. But what we're talking about in the private sector is there might be a 401k where that is where the employer is making contributions towards retirement. They're not making it into a defined benefit plan.
Senator Kretzbach, did you have a question? No. Okay. Representative Grandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But if you take and look at this and you're only dealing with what we have as the 457, your assumption starts out false in that it only takes the partial of the package. No one has a 457 unless they have a defined benefit. So you have to have both if you're going to try to give me a final number of a negative million. I mean, so this brings up a false premise right out of the chute.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's when we get to the second page, that's where it starts to, the impact of that is seen on a combined basis. What we're doing now is just setting out the assumptions, which are valid assumptions, and I'll just repeat the bottom four lines, particularly the bottom three. The typical private sector that has a pension plan, the final formula is 1.5 times salary. The 2% is what yours is. The employer contribution in the private sector, if they have one, the typical employer contribution is 4%. Public sector, read State of North Dakota, yours is a zero match. Okay? And so the employee contribution in the private sector, the most typical average is that they contribute 6%. Okay? And we worked off the assumption, and for those that have it in the public sector, the typical contribution by an employee, even if they don't get a match, is 3%. Okay? So on the second page, we'll show the impact of that.
So eventually you're going to get to the point where you're talking about an apple versus yes. An apple and an orange here?
Well, all the first page is, at the bottom, is the assumptions. Now we're going to show you the impact of the fact of salary and what that does, and as you can see, set out, if the public sector, and we'll explain how we arrived at this conclusion, if the public sector employee in that column called public is a State of North Dakota employee, first of all, they'll earn less over the course of their career, and secondly, their retirement income will be less even though you have an above market pension benefit formula because of the compounded impact of salary. Okay. And Melinda will now explain how we arrived at that.
Yes. So that second box is an apples to apples comparison of your defined benefit, your pension formula, what that annuity would be for a 40-year employee, and starting at the $36,000 salary. So that pension annuity, based on the 2% of your final average pay, is an annual amount of $68,000, close to $69,000. In the private sector, using the 1.5% formula, the annuity is $76,000, close to $77,000. And over the course of a 20-year retirement, we've just added those to be 1.5 million versus almost 1.4.
So we've assumed that employee is going to retire at 65 and live for 20 years.
Representative Casper.
Chairman, Representative, this is not about funding. What this illustration is for the purposes of to set the scene of even though your salaries on average are 7% behind market, and even though your benefits, primarily driven off the retirement plan, are above market, if you look at the remember this is about total compensation, if you look at the impact of salaries being below market over the lifetime of a career of an employee, the fact that the salary is below market will not, and benefits is perceived to be above market through the formula of 2%, you will not close that gap because of the compounded effect of the salary being behind market. And what we want to do is try and work to dispel this myth, quote, that our benefits are so good that we don't need to be competitive on salary. This is not about whether you should or shouldn't have a defined benefit plan, you should or you shouldn't have a defined contribution plan, whether you should fund it at a particular level. It's about the fact that because salaries are behind market, you will not,
This example here, which primarily on the right-hand side, apart from the assumption of starting at 36,000, is North Dakota's plan. They'll earn less on salary and their retirement benefit, if they live for 20 years, will be less. So what we shouldn't be doing is saying, okay, well, our we don't need to do anything about salaries because retirement will take care of it. That's the purpose of the illustration.
Representative Boehning and then Representative Ruby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Neville. When you go back to that, to slide 23, you used the number in the private sector of 40 and the public sector of 36. Are we assuming that when the state hires, we're 10% behind market at that rate at that time, or are we still 7% behind?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, what we've done is, as I said, we've looked historically here. I mean, last year that number could have been on average, when the public sector hires, they've been for a like kind job. You know, what in the private sector has been 40,000, the public sector's typically been more like 36,000, which is what that gap is. So, you know, could we have changed and done an assumption at 7%? Yes. You know, but remember, when we hire, because our salary ranges currently in the state of North Dakota are very wide, our midpoint set at 95% of market, and our minimum of the salary range is 75% of the midpoint. Okay, so take a $40,000 job. We've set our midpoint at 95% of that, which is roughly $38,000. We then have the minimum at 75% of that, which is actually back in the nearly about 30,000. So making an assumption that those two people was, that employee in the state would start at about 36, because we're not going to be hiring them at the midpoint of the range, is, and in fact, if you hadn't done what you'd done the last few years, where you've had a couple of fours and a couple of fives, and you'd be way, if we'd done this 2 years ago, the gap would be, actually 4 years ago, the gap would be even wider because your salaries were way behind the market. So that's where that assumption came from.
Representative Ruby. Senator Kretzlock, I wonder if you would mind pushing your mic down so the machine is not picking it up over here.
Okay. You know, I understand the numbers you're talking about, and I guess I'm kind of curious about this perception and whether that's applying to people who are looking for a job with the state. And in the interim, we heard from some companies on an issue, and there was one, I believe it was in the engineering field, and they had a hard time attracting engineers to their private company because they were competing with the state, and usually if there was an opening at the state, they lost employees to state engineers, to become a state engineer. So I imagine that can be varied depending on the occupation and what industries that would affect, but that perception seems to be a reality to some people when they search for and try to receive a state job. Does that play out in any of these numbers or your data?
Right, Mr. Chairman, Representative, once again, I think you could have 10 different people stand here and say why they joined a particular employer, and you'd probably get 10 different answers. What we've tried to address here is I guess it's more than just a perception, a statement that we hear often in the public sector, which is based on the fact that benefits are seen to be so competitive that people will come and work for us for less salary. Now, they may do that, which is, you know, maybe the testimony you heard. What we've proven is, what we're setting out to prove is not to say, well, that's wrong. We're setting the scene for what you should be. Remember, the primary focus here is not to redesign benefits. It's to say, where should we be setting our level of salaries for going forward? And what we're trying to prove here is that we should have more competitive salaries, because less competitive salaries, comparing the typical benefit, and we've only done retirement here, comparing the typical, because that was the one that's most competitive, even what is a competitive retirement plan over projected over a 40-year career, with the formula that they have in the private sector and the formula that you have in the public sector, they will not only earn less on salary, if they live for 20 years, they'll get less on a retirement benefit. Now, it's not to say we need to do something about those other plans, because what we've been asked to do is, and this is all leading towards, where should our salary policy be set in the marketplace? That's what it's setting the scene for. In other words, we shouldn't be doing a trade-off of 7% behind on salaries, 5 to 7% ahead on benefits, so let's set the salaries where they are at the market, in the marketplace where they are at the moment, because that will make us competitive. Okay, because these other things, which are particularly retirement, which is viewed as above competitive, because of the compounded impact on salaries, will not produce the benefit, even though the formula is better. Compounding here, compounded impact on salary is the key here in the illustration we're giving. Okay, so just to, yeah.
Representative Grandy.
I guess I'm a little slow on this, so will you walk me through this page here, because I'm missing it completely.
So we started comparing a defined benefit plan, the state's defined benefit plan, to the market prevalent defined benefit plan, and that's where we saw the 76 versus 68,000 pension annuity. That third box, what we're showing there is we're showing what typically happens in a private sector organization that does not have a defined benefit plan. They only have a defined contribution plan that provides employees the opportunity to defer their own money, and in return they may get some employer match or a fixed contribution as a function of their salary. So what we've broken it out is we've broken those two components out by what the employer contributes versus what the employee, and then we've added then to what the employee contributes. So in the private sector, you can see that total, that it creates a $126,000 annuity, the defined contribution plan, over the course of and again, that goes back to the employer's contributing 4% on average each year, and the employee's contributed 6% of their own salary each year.
Okay, so that's a 10% investment at 1.5 multiplier.
No, 1.5 multiplier does not come into play. All it is, it's the 10% annually that's going in, compounding for interest, and it's just an account balance.
Okay, and the other one's at 3.
Right, and then what we're saying on North Dakota side is we see that employees may be putting in a portion of their own money to 457, and that comes out to a $29,000 annuity.
And that's based on the 3%?
3%.
Okay, will you walk up to there with your defined contribution annuity, employer contributions only? Where do you come up with the $50,000? Where'd you get that number?
$50,000, that's the annuity created by a 4% annual employer contribution.
Okay. And then the next one, defined contribution total benefit.
That's the accumulation of the $50,000 annuity paid over 20 years. So we're just adding that up. And then the $126,000 annuity, that is the lifetime accumulation of the 6%. Actually, it's the sum of the 4% and the 6%. So it's the employee's contributions plus the employer's contributions and earnings, and that's $126,000 annuity.
Go ahead.
I mean, the difference between that is the $75,000, that's the employee's portion of what they're contributing towards their own retirement.
Say again to me what defined contribution total benefit, how did you arrive at that number?
That is the combination of both the employees, mm-hmm, and the employer's contributions. Mm-hmm. So in total, that's 10% annually, compounded for interest at 7.5% per year for 20 years, or no, for 40 years. Over the life of their career.
Yeah, sure.
Representative Casper.
Thank you, Chairman Grandy. And again, I'll make my point. It's obvious to see that a 10% contribution over a period of time is going to accumulate a whole lot more money than a 3% contribution over time. So obviously your assumptions are starting out that we will never catch up in the formula, because you're using an assumption that may not hold true in the future. And you're using an assumption today that if we, according to today's circumstances, may be true, but if we change to a defined contribution plan, all these things would be different. And maybe you weren't asked to do that, but your numbers, obviously 10% is more than 3%, so it just, to me, doesn't make any sense.
And I think the bottom line is meant to compare a typical private sector organization that has a defined contribution only retirement program to what the state currently has, which is a combination of the defined benefit retirement plan and employee contributions to the 457 plan. And that's where the bottom line is, and that amount adds both the career earnings as well as the value of the benefits to get the 6.5 million versus the 4.8.
Continue.
Thank you, Chairman Grandy. What would have been relevant, you know, from my perspective, is if you would have had a third column, and the third column would have compared if we changed and used the same assumptions on the column one over to the column three with a starting out salary of 36,000. So now we could compare the true accumulation over the same period of time with just at a lower starting salary. That would have been valid from my perspective, but this doesn't give me anything.
Madam Chair, Representative, we can do that. But remember, the purpose of this was not to say whether you should have a defined contribution plan or a defined benefit plan. The purpose of this illustration was to say, having salaries that are less than competitive, even though you have a an actual formula of 2x salary, which is greater than the private sector, if someone works for 40 years and is retired for 20 years, their total payouts through salary and benefits will not be as great as the typical plan in the private sector. But we can do that third column. We can do that for you. But as I said, it may be missing something from what you're asking, but we were not asked to say, should you have a defined benefit plan? This is based on some valid assumptions. This is a comparison of what will occur, driven off the fact that salaries are less than competitive.
And I guess I'll just add that doing this additional scenario would isolate the impact of the career salary earnings on your ultimate retirement benefit, but you wouldn't be varying the retirement benefit. So I understand that case, but you would still show the compounding impact of what a reduced salary would have on your retirement benefit.
Can you walk me through the second portion where it says pension annuity, pension total benefit? How did you come up with those numbers? Your second grouping there?
Yes, the pension annuity, that's taking the last four. So in the case of the private sector, it is more common to use the final 5 years of pay, an average of the final 5 years of pay. In determining the benefit. So we've taken those final 5 years multiplied by the 1.5% formula times the years of service, which would be 40 in this case, to come out with an annuity. I mean, it would normally be a monthly annuity, but we just annualized it. And same is the case. The only difference in the second column is the fact that we use the final 3 years of pay, which is the formula for North Dakota.
Times two.
So I'm going to add I'm going to add the 2,800,000 and the 1,300,000 to get to box number four.
Yes, 4.2.
Okay, so we're still. This is where my frustration is. I'm still only dealing with the 457 and their full benefit package and our little partial package. When am I going to see the numbers dealing with my defined benefit plan that I have?
That is the
defined benefit plan.
Okay, so you're telling me this is my defined benefit in box number two?
Yes.
Okay.
So, Representative, if an employee in the private sector only had a defined benefit plan, put aside the defined contribution element, they're going to have earned 3.9 salary and they're going to be earning 1.5 of benefit, and your state of North Dakota employee 2.8 and 1.37. assuming they both live for 20 years.
So you have just shown me that a defined contribution plan is far better for the employee at a lower multiplier because they're going to have a better benefit package.
There's no multiplier in a defined contribution plan, though. It's whatever gets accumulated.
This is their defined, they have a defined contribution plan, but you've given them a, in, theirs is defined contribution. Yeah, it says DC plan right there on the page one.
Right, so the third box represents the accumulation of 4% in employer contributions annually and 6% in employee contributions annually of their pay. Mm-hmm. And there's no multiplier in that other than investment earnings earned, you know.
Right. So again, I'm saying, okay, then they come out almost $2 million ahead if they went into a defined contribution versus defined benefit.
And Representative, that's the, you know, as I said, we were not asked to determine whether there should be a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan, but it's these sort of numbers that come up in the debate.
So they are better off in a defined contribution.
The point is, as I said, I'll repeat myself again, is to show that we, based on the current plan that you have, which is a salary plan that's less than competitive and a defined benefit plan, that we should not be offsetting decisions on salary because of the non-contribution to a retirement plan and a 2% formula. That was the point of why we were doing this.
Okay.
And I think I'll add to this that we're assuming that this employee contributes towards their retirement. That's not required of them to do, so you could have employees that would have no employer, you know, no retirement in a defined contribution arrangement because there's no required contribution.
Representative Boehning.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Question, I'm still going back to that slide 23. You know, you start out 10% below market with the hiring. At any point in the 40 years, do you get up to that 93% of market in the calculations that you used?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think we need to disconnect those two. What we've done is the 93 of where you are relative to the market is really independent of this analysis, because what you got, it works off the assumption that the public sector employee would start at a lower salary, which has been the case. What it doesn't take into consideration, and then it assumes the average increase, 3%, going back 40 years, where that places someone in their salary range doesn't really matter in terms of the calculations that are being done. Okay, because it's somewhat irrelevant because the private sector might have a smaller salary range or a wider salary range. It's where their starting salary was. Okay, we've just assumed that they're going to get a 3% increase every year for 40 years, and the private sector employee got a 4% increase. And if you look back the last 40 years, that's a valid assumption. That's primarily what's occurred. So where they are in their salary range doesn't really impact that. Ready to move on? So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as I said, and I'm repeating myself now, the purpose of doing that was to say that we can take a total compensation perspective in setting salary ranges. We needed to establish some salary ranges so that we could tell you what potential fiscal impact was. There are two factors that need, two factors taken into consideration in determining salary ranges. One is internal equity, that's relativity within the state, and circuity is external competitiveness. And a salary structure will take into consideration both of those. In House Bill 1031, it talked about allowing for multiple pay structures. We talked about the fact that we may in fact develop multiple pay structures. As we got into analyzing the data, we think that you can continue to have one salary structure and you can continue to use what we call premium pay grades for some jobs where the market is higher, such as example being a physician. So that does not preclude the development of multiple salary structures for occupational groups. The issue on occupational group pay is actually getting them closer to the market rather than that the market is significantly higher for them. So what we've done is we were asked to develop a couple of salary structure options. And one sets the policy position at the average of the salary market, and two sets it at 98% of the average of the salary market. One says we should be competitive on salaries because we know the competitiveness of our benefits is going to be dropping back a little. The other says that, you know, let's be pragmatic. We don't need to necessarily get all the way to the market average immediately. Let's set a structure that's at 98% of the market. In terms of the structure of the salary ranges, currently you have now a 75% minimum, a midpoint, and 125% maximum. I don't see the point of having a minimum that's so far behind the market. And so what we're recommending now is that the minimum of the range be 80%. We can no longer call it a midpoint because it's not a mathematical midpoint. We'll call it the market policy position with the range maximum being set at 125%. Movement through those ranges would be in accordance with the compensation philosophy, which says they'll be open ranges, they won't have steps. Combination of factors of performance, competency, changes in job content, and so on. So we've developed two structure options from that perspective. Then what we did was we went through and said, now what's the fiscal impact of doing that? There are typically a minimum fiscal impact on page 27 and a maximum fiscal impact, and we were asked to provide those dollars. The minimum fiscal impact is the cost to bring employees who are below minimum to the minimum of the salary range. If we believe there should be a minimum, why would we pay employees less than the minimum of a salary range? The maximum fiscal impact, which we were asked to calculate, was what would be the cost to bring employees who are below minimum below the market policy position to the market policy position? In other words, that's effectively market policy budgeting. If we believe that's our market policy, what would that cost be? So if you said to me, what's the least we should do? The least you should do is based on the salary ranges we've developed, we should at least get people into the salary ranges. The maximum would be, let's provide funding so that we can get on average a comp ratio of 100% to those ranges. Now, there is a step in between that can be utilized upon implementation. It's what we call the XYZ formula. And hopefully I won't lose you here, but let me explain how that comes about. Let's assume we have two employees. And one of them is paid $5,000 below the minimum, and one is paid a dollar above the minimum on the new salary ranges, for different reasons. But I'm going to assume they've both been with us for 10 years, and they've both performed equally. I'm going to assume that one of them's been here 6 months, and the other one's been here 10 years. And the one who's $5,000 below minimum is the one who's been here 6 months. And the one who's above $1 above the minimum has been here 10 years, has been a good performer. Upon implementation, if all we did was the minimum, that gap, which previously was $5,001, would now be $1. And the new kid on the block goes, this is a good plan. And the one who's been around 10 years goes, this ain't too good. And so what XYZ does is effectively alleviate some compression that we just created, because we've got a big bulge around the minimum. And so we can do a one-time formula that says, okay, for those who are above minimum but below midpoint, below the market policy, they'd get, and you can plug in whatever numbers you want to XYZ, they get X percent of salary for Y in the current classification to a maximum. I'll give you an example. It might be 0.5 for 10 years to a maximum of 5%. And all it is doing is alleviating compression. And you don't need to determine that as a committee. If you say, basically, depending on the amount of money that's available for implementation, we can do something like that. So if you go over now two pages, what's the fiscal impact of what we're recommending? And we were asked to do this by three funds. And I should point out that the market analysis was done based on actual salaries. We were asked to do the projections for this based on budgeted salaries. And the two aren't necessarily the same because they take into consideration vacancies, et cetera, et cetera. It's been actually one of the biggest challenges we've had in the last few weeks, trying to get a match of that data. The budget talks about, you know, a 50% employee, 25% employee, all those sort of things. So we've had to roll everything up to a full-time equivalent. So based on the first option, the cost to bring to minimum is just over $4 million. And then if you said, by the way, this is on an annualized basis, and if you said the additional cost to bring to the market policy position of the new range is just under $23 million. In the general fund, and you can see the federal fund and the special fund, and then the counties, which are treated separately, but you can see a line item for the counties as well. If you go over to page 30, based on the scenario of 98% of market, the numbers, and you'd mathematically you'd go, well, if it's 2% less, the cost drops by 2%. It doesn't. It drops by about 10%. And we've given a reason, we've given a scenario as to why that's the case at the bottom of page 30. So that in some cases it drops by even more, what was 6.3 million is now 4.9 million. General fund, which was 4.047, drops to 3.11 million. And you go, how could just a 2% different, how could that be the case? And we put an example at the bottom there. Current employee earning current pay of $100,500. The cost to bring to minimum, the cost to bring to market policy position was $2,100, whereas the market policy position on the other scenario they would not need any money. So even though the range is only 2% lower, the cost for that particular employee drops by 100%. Then what we were asked to do was break this out by agencies. And that is set out on pages, the remaining pages, actually the next few pages. So what this does is take that macro numbers and breaks it out by agency, by fund. And you can see here basically the cost to bring to minimum of a budgeted payroll by agencies on 31 and 32. And of the 4.047 million, as you can see, over 2.8 million of that is in two agencies, one being Human Services and the other being in Corrections and Rehabilitation. When we looked at the positions, and even though we used some benchmark positions, when we did the numbers behind these pages here, there are a significant number of professional level positions in the general human services field that are below minimum. Disability managers, case managers, MI case managers, voc rehab type positions, etc. And so there's a significant number of those, most of which are in DHS. And so that's why not only is it the biggest agency, so you'd expect it to have the biggest cost, but in terms of being below market, you know, that, remember that on average 7%, but they on average were 13% behind market. And they are a significant chunk, and so that's why the overall sum to get to midpoint is more like 14% than 7%, because that 7% was based on benchmarks. This is effectively based on every single position. And the more, it's effectively a weighted on an individual basis. Many of the positions are in human services, many of the positions that are significantly low are human service type jobs, you know, the cost to bring to midpoint is more than just 7% from that perspective. So that's on option one. Federal funds is set out on page 33. And once again, you can see human services takes up the chunk of that. And special funds are set out on 34 and 35. And Alan, for your purposes, I don't know what special funds is, but that's that generic category. I presume there's multiple special funds, correct? but for the purposes of the analysis we were asked to do, it's lumped into those three categories. Then what 36, 37, 38, etc. does is do the same analysis based on option two, which is setting the market policy position at 98% of the market. And so you can scroll through those. So I want to summarize what those numbers mean. I have no control over those numbers in terms of what you do with them, other than if you said, so Neville, what are you recommending? I've given you parameters within which we were asked to provide, which is pick your option, but assuming you chose option one, as a minimum we should be funding, from a general fund perspective, roughly $4 million. As a maximum, we should be funding on an annualized basis roughly $23 million. And so, Mr. Chairman, I come back to you. The point that you made before was whether this committee makes a decision. I think what our aim here has been to give you the information by which you can give a directive through the what you mentioned through the OMB budget to say, okay, how much. It's my understanding from Alan that there's been money put, you know, that 3%. From a general fund perspective is 22.9 million, roughly 23 million, I think, or something like that. Is that annually or over a biennium? Over a biennium. What does that, you know, so I'll use round figures. 11.5 million has been appropriated. I presume that's general fund money. What would 11.5 do? How much more do we potentially need to appropriate? That's been the intention of giving you these sort of parameters of numbers. What I would strongly encourage you to do is when you consider whether more appropriation is needed, I would strongly recommend that you fund the move to minimum separately. Because if you take up some of that 3% for funding to minimum, there isn't anything, there may potentially not be much, if the numbers are, follow your numbers. If you add 11 million from the general fund for the first year, and we use up 4 million of that for moving to minimum, then what was perceived as a 3% will not be a 3%. You're not going to have 3% available. So while it's not my job to say how you should fund these, I would strongly encourage you to use a separate funding for moving to minimum so that still leaves money available for some of these, for what you intend to do for the remaining employees. One other thing that I should touch on, which is this issue of the impact of the oil patch. I remember at one of the very first sessions that we attended in the audit, I got asked the question, so we've had truck drivers earning 45, leaving for 85, what should we do? And my response was shake their hand and wish them all the best, because you can't bridge a $40,000 gap for someone who chooses to go and do that. And so we need to take into consideration what we should do with the oil patch, which primarily affects DOT but does affect some other agencies as well. And while we can deal, and there's a difference between the oil patch issue and what I'd consider to be premium pay issues. And I'll give you an example of a premium pay issue. A pharmacist, we may be in a particular grade where there's 11 positions. And 10 of them, and they may have a midpoint of, say, for their job content of, say, $70,000. And that works for 9 of the 10 positions. But the pharmacist, the market is $100,000, and is likely to continue to be a premium pay position. So that would be a premium pay. Now, what we have to be careful of is in the oil patch is to avoid a boom-bust approach to salaries. Now, for all projections, that's going to go on for a while, but you've been through the bust part of it. And if we load all that into salary and a bust occurs, then you're paying too much. So the way that we recommend, and this will be firmed up as part of the process of what do we do about recruitment retention, is that we believe it should be addressed through three things. One is potentially paying recruitment. Two, what we call a pay add-on. And what's a pay add-on compared to a premium pay? A pay add-on says the going market is typically, say, $50,000. The oil patch at this point in time is paying $80,000, but we don't know if that's going to last. So we treat it as a 50 plus 30, and we put a little asterisk next to the 30, and we put a sunset clause on it. Now, and the sunset clause may be 3 years down the road, and we may find it still appropriate, so we'd renew it. But if bust occurs, we're not paying $80,000 forever and a day. The second is to provide accommodation assistance, which we can do through an allowance. But treat those two as effectively allowances, one being a salary allowance and the other being an accommodation allowance, so that if bus comes, we're not built in, we haven't built it in forever. Now, recruitment pay currently has to be funded through vacancies. The question that I think needs to be considered in the appropriation process is, should we be providing, or what for a generic name, I'll call it all patch add-on and accommodation money. At the moment, it's my understanding the agencies have to find that money from within their own budgets through vacancies. Should we, in fact, be giving agencies that are affected a pot of money? If you said to me, Neville, answer your own question, I would say yes, because it's a true market. Now, I don't know what the value should be, because not all the positions that we studied were the positions that are impacted by that. But I'm sure the agencies and HRMS could quickly do some calculation on that. The point that I'm making, both on funding for minimum and these sort of things, is the more that we ask for those to be funded out of, well, we're giving 3%, if we have to fund these particular needs, then we don't have 3% available. It becomes 2%, it becomes 1.8%, etc. Fund special needs through special funds, not your term special funds, special pots of money is probably the way that I should express it. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee that still remain, the consultant's now going to do a phantom heart attack to see if he's got a heart and see if they run in like they did for you. No, the intention was, I go back to the initial introduction, the intention was to give you today the information you need to be able to see if there's a fiscal impact. We spent a whole lot of time, more than I expected, as to why we've recommended the salary ranges that we have in terms of the impact, because I didn't want you saying that our benefits, our retirement plan's so good that we don't need to be setting competitive salary ranges, and that was the intention of those two pages. So what we've presented to you is information so that we can meet the need that you have, which is to give some fiscal direction through the budget process. So I really leave it over to you in terms of questions that anyone may have. I'm also interested in direction as to what we would be doing if we met again next week. I'll pose questions to you. Is it so people have a chance to think about this, come back, I'm not sure what more we want direction, I'm sort of putting out, we want direction, what other analysis do you want done? Or secondly, what additional material do you need? Would it be a question and answer session? I'm not asking you to answer them, but that's, we're due to meet again in 1 week. What would we be doing? So,
first, why don't we see if there are any questions on any of the information that we've... Then seeing no questions, any comments or suggestions as to what kind of additional information the Hague Group might provide next week? Looks kind of open-ended. What kind of a time frame are you?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, when we talked about, and you remember that the initial contract for this phase said everything was to be finished by April the 30th. And I've explained to you previously that some of the components that we're working on have really been dependent on this rebuilding of the house. And so we set a meeting for a preliminary report and then a final report of stuff that, I shouldn't use that term, but of material that you needed so that you as legislators could make your decisions. If you believe you have the sort of information you need for decisions or direction that you've been giving for budget process here, my suggestion is other than people need to process this material and that have questions, which they may very well, then I'm not sure, from my answer, I'm not sure that there's much more that we can prepare other than could you rerun this? It's not like we can redo the market analysis. We can't redo the benefits analysis, etc. The analysis has been done. We could utilize next week for we've had a chance to process it, etc., etc. What I would encourage you to do, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is that in terms of producing a final report, and I've already spoken to Alan and Sarah about this, about extending the contract to the 30th of June from a time frame perspective, that so that you were charged with oversight of all the components, that we meet again, regardless of whether we meet next week, that we schedule a meeting in June where we can give you a final report on all the components, some of which we can now work on once we get some direction, yeah, we're on the right track here. So that's, I'm looking at both of you from that perspective. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me, but I think we'd need to visit with the chairman of legislative management to talk about beyond the session. Any other questions of Neville? If not, then I think the next agenda item we have is a presentation by somebody from OMB. Is that you, Ken?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This will be very short. We've just seen the report today too, and kind of looked over things and part of the process was Neville asking us observations on the data and describing the data to us and so forth, and asking, did anything shock you? Did anything surprise you? Does anything look out of line and so forth? And I guess our observation really has been no. The things really kind of fit together, and it really makes sense. I went back to not 40 years, but to 2007, and recalled reporting to the Joint Appropriations Committees on the first week of the legislative session, talking about our salaries lagging 11% to 17%. Representative Svejan at the end of that presentation asked, well, how much to get to market? I really hated to answer that question, but I had to. The answer at that point in time was 50 to 60 million. 26 to 30 million general fund. And since then, the legislature over two sessions has appropriated $33 million in market equity funds, 18 general, plus had increased appropriations of 4 and 4 and 5 and 5. And that, coupled with the national economy being pretty slow, has really brought us much closer to market and resulting in the data that the Hay Group has presented today. And so we really, I think that funding really did make a difference and has brought things closer, and we're in better shape than we were. This is kind of an opportunity to really get in sync with the employment market, with a more precise employment market, and a better measured employment market, and a better structure of our classified jobs that we've gone through the evaluation in recent months. The amount of 6 million, 4 million general fund to get to the new minimums, 23 general fund to get to market is the lowest number that's ever been discussed, and so it kind of presents that opportunity. And then in an aggregate sense, the 3% increase also reduces those numbers a little bit, because that contributes to the overall move of employee salaries. So that's really all I have to observe today, based on the information provided. It's it's the closest we've been in a long time, and the best our economy's been in a long time, and so it presents an opportunity. And as Neville has said frequently, the benefits, while strong and powerful, don't make up for that base salary, and so that probably continues to be a focus of working through that balance, and I suspect that there's going to be continued work on the benefits over the next interim, and the Employee Benefits Committee will continue working on those areas and so forth. That's about all I can add to the conversation at this point.
I guess one thing that I'm curious about, maybe we can talk about it next week, is whether there is any direction that OMB needs from
legislatively before the end of the session beyond what's already being considered in the implementation of this, and we can talk about that.
And I think some of the follow-up discussion would be between discussion with the budget staff and fiscal staff and OMB and look a little more detail in the numbers and so forth. Over the last couple of weeks, Sarah and Lori from the budget office and I have been going back and forth with the Hague group and trying to get all the numbers sorted out and reconciling the current payroll data and the budget numbers and the, you know, all of this kind of stuff, and it's turned out to be very complex. And now that we have some of these numbers laid out, this summary laid out, I think we can have some further discussions with the budget staff in terms of, you know, what's necessary or what, you know, how does this impact and so forth. So, because it's the first time they've seen this summary of information too.
Okay, thank you. Then the next item on the agenda is any other interested persons that might have anything they'd like to share with us. Seeing none, the next item is committee discussion and staff directives. Is there anything that needs to be brought forward at this time? If not, we'll adjourn.